that will go in her signal. I don't have that. Okay, I have a liquid xenon detector, which gets scintillation out of it, gets ionization out of it, but most of the energy goes in phonons, and I don't see that. So when the question was about energy calibration, that's typically much more of an issue for us than for her, because she sees all the energy anyway. When I mean xenon TPCs, I'm not here on behalf of the collaboration, which is great. I can talk my mouth. I really mean, you know, the whole armada, Zeppelin detectors, then xenon 10, 100, 1 ton running now. Xenon N-ton will be coming online soon, but also Lux, PandaX, our Chinese colleagues, eventually LZ, and hopefully, and I count on your support, the ultimate detector, Darwin, or whatever you are going to call it. What those detectors were built for is weak scale, you know, 100 GeV-ish dark matter detectors, where you say, okay, you have, you know, 100 GeV dark matter, then you want to have a target of similar mass, so you match the impedances, you get the optimum recoil, and you look for nuclear recoils. And so the way you do that is you extract from your liquid xenon time projection chamber two signals, the ionization signal, which we call in jargon S2, and the scintillation signal, which we call in S1. And so the more signal you see, the more energy deposited you have. Okay, great. So let's just see whether the detector works. Let's use a calibration source. In this case, we introduce a radioactive beta source to the detector, which is a bit crazy, right? You deliberately introduce radioactivity to your super pure detector. It's like, okay, different story. Not the talk right here. You introduce that calibration source, and what you find is that your calibration events go along the yellow line, right? The median and whatever, one sigma bars. And so what you see is that anything that scatters off an electron and kicks an electron through your detector, you will see along those yellow lines. And I don't care what that is. This can be a beta or gamma, as in the calibration, but it can also be a leptophilic dark matter or a neutrino, whatever you want. Because what you see, as always in particle physics, right, you never see the actual particle that you're interested in, never. You always only see what the effect of that particle is on your detector. In this case, you have an electron recoiling through your detector. You see the ionization track. Typical energies in our detector here are about 2 kilo electron volt electron equivalent. Okay, that's not what we built the detector for. What we built the detector for is to look for nuclear recoils. So you have something else kicking the nucleus. In particular, neutrons do that, and of course, WIMPs would do that too. Now you have a big fat xenon nucleus flying through the xenon. The ionization density is very, very, very different because you have a different ionization density. The S2, the ionization signal, is actually quenched. And you see that those nuclear recoils follow along the blue line. Energy scale is also different because, again, I don't have a colorimeter, right? So I need to look what I'm, the energy scale that I have depends whether I'm looking at electronic or nuclear recoils. And so you see typical energies here are 10 kilo electron volt nuclear recoils. Okay, great. Let's remove all the calibration sources and let's do a run. This is the result that we presented from xenon 1 ton a few weeks ago. And what you see is, well, in green shaded is just where you would expect your dark matter to, your WIMPs to be. But you see only the white events, which all follow the yellow line. And so you say, oh, that's background bummer. You don't see anything, derive a limit, and you're done. Well, except that there's quite a bit more that you can do with those detectors. And that's, of course, what Maxime hinted on earlier, right? What we have to make sure is as we build those detectors, and as those detectors become more expensive, where expensive is still cheap, right? I mean, the xenon 1 ton is $10 million. Right? Atlas collaboration meeting is how many million dollars, right? So, but what you want to make sure is that you extract the most information out of that. We haven't done that with xenon 1 ton yet, but we certainly have that done with xenon 100. And so what I'm giving you here is a little bit of an overview about the analyses that we have done. Ask me for the references because there's too many that the slide would be too full about. What you can do is you can interpret that in terms of the standard WIMPs for spin-independent or spin-dependent scattering. But you can also say, you know, really that's, you know, that spin-independent, spin-dependent, that's Jungmann et al. Review, that's, you know, 1990s. You should do that in an effective field theory approach. We did that too. And maybe, like, if you have any stakes in that, please talk to me because I'm still not sure we get this right. Also, you can look for inelastic dark matter, if you like DAMA. Or you can try to push this analysis to lower masses, and I'll be talking about that. So if you say, you know, I don't want 100 GeV WIMPs, but I'm looking at, you know, what else can I do? Can I push this to 10 GeV or 1 GeV dark matter? And the answer is yes, you can, and we have publications about that. But then what we learned, or what we found just a couple of years ago, is that now actually the background that we're having is so low because about all those things that we do that I'm not talking about here, that you can do useful stuff with the background alone. So we're interpreting the background and you know what we see and what we understand in terms of leptophilic dark matter, stuff that wants to couple with electrons, axial vector couplings, for example, or very light dark matter, MeV scale, that would scatter off the electrons. You can look for some crazy ideas. I don't think the luminous dark matter authors object me giving them that adjective. Mirror dark matter, you can look for inelastic scatters where dark matter upscatters the xenon. That's nice, because if you were to see a signal, you would learn about the dark matter halo. That's great. Magnetic inelastic dark matter, which is double scatters. We have a paper about that. Gamma is ruled out, if you have any sense of that, but Neil and Doug are not here, so I guess. You can look for axion-like particles, dark photons, super WIMPs, solar axions. That's not dark matter. You can see whether there's, you know, KEV, heavy sterile neutrinos that might increase your electronic recall spectrum. My guess is that with the CREST detectors that are going to evil lower energies, those spectra go up very steeply. You'll be really good at that. You can look for double electron capture on xenon 124. I'm not yet familiar very much with the neutrino community. Do we have like an exo person here? I thought there's a talk, but okay. If you are an exo neutrinoless double beta decay with xenon 136, you should be actually quite excited about that, because if we measure double electron capture, you know, neutrino double beta decay, double electron capture is the same process. On xenon 124, that is feasible to be measured with xenon 1 ton. We'll find out, depends on what the half-life is, which is unknown within two orders of magnitude, and that is because the nuclear structure functions are unknown, the matrix elements are unknown. So by us measuring that, you'll get a data point from which you can hook your matrix element calculations for the neutrinoless double beta decay on xenon 136. Joseph.
So what's the Q value? Is this in the MeV regime?
No. This is a 60 kV line electron capture. Right now, okay. you get one or two X-rays out. Electron capture is you capture two electrons at the same time. Now you have two vacancies; those you fill up, and so you see the binding energy of the electrons. That's all you see, and that's a line at I think 60 kV.
But the Q value,
I have no idea what the Q value is.
Yeah, but there's the nucleus.
I don't know what the Q value is. I mean xenon, so it's going to be similar. Cesium. Barium, yes.
And here it goes backwards.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what you see is that there's really a long list suddenly. So for the xenon detectors, we are at a different position than where we started out. We are at a point where we really built just this knife, but what we find is that we have a multi-channel detector with which we can look for all kinds of dark matter models, actually. And please talk to me if you have other ideas, right? For example, what's that thing for, right? I mean, there's so many things you can do, right? We have that tool, and we're really looking for other things to do with it. Okay. That's actually not really my introduction, not really what I'm talking about. Because you can ask, okay, so you want to push this forward. We're building the detectors. We have those detectors. We want to make them better so we can do more with them. And so what you would like to do is, what you can ask is the question, why can't you go to lower energies? What's wrong there? And you just look at that plot, and you find that this band here, by the way, there's events below in this gray line, but you find that this band is chopped vertically at three photoelectrons in S1, right? It's not chopped like that. It's chopped like that. So what this tells you is just that we are limited by the light collection. The reason is very simple. That is because we have a built-in amplification stage in the detector called electroluminescence. The detector itself gives us a factor 100 or so amplification for ionization signals. You can see that, right? At threshold 3 and 300, right? You get this factor 100 amplification. So you can go much lower if you don't have to rely on this S1, on the scintillation signal, if you can do without that. This is often called an S2 only analysis, and this is really a misnomer, because it's not that I only look at S2s, but it's just that I don't require S1s. Maybe somebody can come up with a better name. Well, the problem is, so the nice feature about those detectors is that they work really beautifully. To an amazing, as far as I'm concerned, sensitivity. There's this 2 tons of liquid xenon in my detector, bless you. It's like a meter by a meter. And I can see a single electron that is liberated by whatever interaction you can cook up with. Anywhere in the detector, I will see it. I will drift it up. I will amplify it by a factor 100. And that's a signal. Well, that's a xenon 100 signal. But anyway, that's what those signals look like. You get a big whopping signal out of your detector, even from just a single electron. You're far above noise. That's really cool. Lux, for example, has shown that you can go to really, really low energies. This is 190 electron volts. So why don't we really yet make use of that? What's holding us back? Well, that's shown by this plot. If you do a dark matter analysis where so you want to push it, your detectors, to the realm where you don't rely on the S1, so you do this S2-only analysis, xenon 10 pioneered that, then you can go to lower WIMP masses. That's great. The GeV range here, right, 5, 6, 7. Usually, you wouldn't be able to probe that parameter range. Of course, those curves here are nonsense at this range because, I mean, you see how steep they are, right? They are not really there. You see the xenon 10 curve, and you say, okay, great, now I have xenon 100, which is an order of magnitude better. It'll be an order of magnitude better limit, and you do the analysis, and you go like, ah, you essentially get the same limit, right? And so what this is telling you is that there's some background, or if you want to be an optimist, some dark matter signal that you're, yeah, no. Some background that you're running up against that hasn't been tackled. And the background that we haven't tackled is actually two different backgrounds. One comes from photoionization. Now it's like 3 technical slides for the theorists. Now's your time to fall asleep. One background is photoionization, and this is just because xenon scintillation light, the light that we detect from any particle interactions, 178, 175 nanometers, that's 7 electron volts or so. That's a lot of energy. If you had that photon hitting a metal surface, for example, it can photoionize the metal. Now, I have a free electron in my detector, I have an electric field, I will drift that up. That's a signal, and that's a background. I can prove that this is to you that this is happening. This is data from xenon 100, where we show as function of the drift time here, those signals at very, very, very low S2 values, so single electrons, and you see those spikes. These are actually our field-shaping rings. In xenon 100, we had like this weird design where we had copper field-shaping rings on the inside of the detector. So the xenon scintillation light would be able to see the copper photoionized in it. And then you can count the individual field-shaping rings and see, oh, yeah, they're still all there, right? So that's happening on the metal surface. But it's also happening on impurities in the liquid xenon. That's what this plot shows. The xenon is not always the same purity. You try to purify it continuously, so over time your purity gets better, meaning as function of purity, you can measure how much of those backgrounds you have, of those single electron S2 backgrounds, and you see it correlates very nicely. So yes, you do have photoionization on impurities. These are backgrounds. What you do against them, I think, is clear, right? You get rid of metal surfaces. We don't have field-shaping rings on the inside anymore. And you make your target as pure as possible. Is actually not the main worry. Yes? Ha, yes, yes, Maxime got it, that's the next slide. It's actually not the main worry for another reason, and that is that those events, they will to first order go away after the maximum drift time, right? You have a flash of light from, say, whatever, an alpha particle or a high energy Compton scatter, it doesn't matter, that creates those photoionization events. They will drift to the surface, they will pop up, pop, 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 and then they're gone after one maximum drift time. So that's not really a worry because you just have to wait this one maximum drift time and you know, that's done. The problem is, Maxime already pointed out, the intercept is not at zero. Well, how do you see that the intercept is not at zero? Do you just calculate the slope? This thing doesn't go to zero, zero, right? I mean, the intercept isn't at zero, but did you just guess that? I give you credits that you calculated that in your head. Wow. So let's zoom out a little bit, and this is the plot that is coming from Jinke at APS last year, how it looks like in Lux, of how those events actually look like. Here's what's happening in your detector, you know, nothing much, whatever, some background counts, who cares. And now you have a particle interaction, a Compton scatter, an alpha, whatever it is. Now this particle interaction, together with all the associated photoionization, will be over in one maximum drift time, which in Lux was 0.3 milliseconds. Look at the scale that I'm having here. This is milliseconds. 0.3 milliseconds is that line, right? But look at that. There is another background mechanism in those detectors that keeps keeps single electrons pop out from your events over timescales that are two or three orders of magnitude longer than those that you typically have in your detector. And I think the new development here is that from February this year that Peter really nailed that. We were always suspecting that this might be due to delayed extraction, so where you have electrons drifting up to the top liquid surface then, but then you know there's a potential barrier they need to jump from the liquid in the gas phase to create the electroluminescence. And maybe there's some trapping happening there and then you can have a long time scale there. That was long thought, but I think he really nailed it with some considerations that this is actually what is going on. And so we understand that background now as well. And of course the question is now, if that's really what it is, what do you do about it? And so at this point, it's time for some advertisement. Climber for $64.99. We are just forming the UA1 prime project. It's a joke in there. No? Okay, thank you. So this is Adam at LNL, Peter at LVNL, Kaishwan at San Diego, and me currently. You know, let me know if you're interested. Where we are collecting some really critical R&D expertise and lots of small detectors in our labs where we can try out new ideas. For example, try different meshes. This one is one from Kaishwan. This is technical, sorry. But you know, it's just beautiful. It's graphene evaporated on fused silica instead of a mesh to help with the extraction. Or you can think of, you know, putting red LEDs to flash the liquid layer, so to give the electrons just enough energy to jump out. PMTs should be blind to that. Where we try to reduce that and mitigate this background to reduce it. And if we're able
to... The objective is just to beat down the delayed extraction.
Pardon, say that again?
The objective is just to beat down the delayed extraction.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So for example, with the LEDs, you could think that if you provide the electrons up there sufficient energy to jump out immediately, you can leave this on because the PMTs are not sensitive to red light, they are sensitive to UV light, and then you get rid of this background. Why would you want to do that? Well, for starters, it's because then you can actually build, and that's what this project is about, you can build your precision tool, right? There you go. It's small, but it can do something quite nice, better than the big ones can, and that is you can drip into the 10 MeV range or so. This is a plot coming from Ruben via Peter, where you look for thermorelic particles, not necessarily WIMPs, but in the MeV range or the Friesen particles. The arrow points where you are at about 3 events per kilogram year. So in this range, 2, you don't really need a very big detector. Also, you don't necessarily need low background components. You can build this from commercial devices, just like Xenon 10 was built from commercial systems. That's one thing that's really nice. And you could also do that quickly, right? It's just like Frederica. With a lot of those new ideas that are coming up, these things can be done very quickly for not a lot of money. So I think we should do that. But then what you can also do about that is you can improve the sensitivity of the big detectors to neutrinos, at which point you should go like, whoa. Well, okay, wait. I'm here to talk about dark matter, not about neutrinos, right? How can I talk about neutrinos? Borg-Xeno, 280 tons, Super-K, 50 kilotons, Ice Cube, of course, a gigaton of target. And here I am telling you that my 2-ton detector, teensy-weensy, is actually sensitive to neutrinos. How can that be? And the answer is can be for due to two reasons, if I can exploit them. One is if I can go to low recoil energies where nobody else can go, then I can say something about neutrinos that nobody else could say about it. But more importantly, I can make use of the fact that neutrinos may coherently scatter on the nucleus, and so I make use of the cross-section going like the mass number of the nuclei squared, which for xenon is 100 squared. So my 2 tons become 2 orders of magnitude more, right? A factor 100 more. So suddenly I have a 200-ton equivalent neutrino detector, and now I'm game, and now I'm talking. What do we do with that? I'm running a little bit behind. What you can look for is elastic scattering of neutrinos. You don't benefit from the coherent factor. So this is the Monte Carlo from the xenon 1-ton background. Maybe or maybe not. We will show next week how it actually looks like. Looks the same. And what you see is that the pink curve, like 1 order of magnitude below the total background, you have a signal from PP solar neutrinos that can sit there. To measure that with xenon 1-ton, you'll need like a year of data. no problem. We should have it by the end of the year. But then, of course, you want to do better than what has already been done, for example, by Borixino. Right? If I have a 3-sigma measurement, that means 30% precision. If I want to do better than Borixino, which I think has 10% precision, then you need like, you know, a few years. Xenon-1-ton is probably not running long enough to actually make a measurement where you improve. Certainly, Xenon-N-ton, LZ, and of course Darwin will make very, very good measurements of this neutrino flux, potentially even going to the beryllium 7-1, and I don't know. Then the other thing is the coherent scattering. Just a comment here, which sometimes gets lost when people talk about that. You've all seen this plot where we have the dark matter cross sections and the Lewis curve that we put on this from the coherent scattering. The point is twofold. Number one, you get coherence if the transferred momentum is larger than the size of the nucleus. You get this A square scaling. And you can put it on the same plot because all that matters here is essentially non-relativistic scattering. So it's just the transferred momentum, which is mass times velocity or mass times energy. So it's clear that you are degenerate between mass and energy, right? It's just the momentum. So you can have either a heavy, slow WIMP creating a signal, or you can get the same signal from a fast and light neutrino because it's just the momentum. And that's why you can put fast light neutrinos on the same plot as heavy, slow WIMPs. So that's just what's going on there. You see that we might have a discovery potential with xenon 1-ton. In particular, if we can push down the energy threshold, that should be feasible. Here's a plot of how this will look like in LC, is where this is coming from. It's the same in xenon 1-ton because the relative scaling is arbitrary. So that's quite nice. You see those events down here from boron 8 are a very nice signal, but at lowest energies. They are not a background to the standard WIMPs that you built your detector for originally. But they are a signal to hunt for and to go for. Quite nice. To do that, why would you want to do that? And this plot comes from Louis, or this statement comes from Louis. What you could do is you could clarify, maybe eventually, with something like xenon n-ton or LZ in a couple of years from now, the solar metallicity, because you get something like 90 events per ton per year above, say, 1 kilo-electron-volt nuclear recoil. And the fun thing is there that, you know, heliosolar seismology says you get 6 × 10⁶ events, but you know, hydrodynamical simulation says now it should only be 4, and Borixino measures smack on in the middle 5, and you go like, ah, what is it? And so you don't know. So I think we should be able to help there. I have 2 more minutes. The thing that I'm currently in the realm of neutrinos most excited about is because we can do it right now and can do something that nobody can do right now, then that's galactic supernova neutrinos. You have a fuses. If there's a galactic supernova neutrino, going off, you get a very short neutrino burst. It's just a few seconds of 10 MeV or so neutrinos. And because we are looking for coherent scattering, we would be sensitive to all flavors. We're the only running experiment to be sensitive to all flavors. So in principle, that's really nice because it means you can now calorimetrically measure the total energy in a supernova that goes into neutrinos. That's really, really good. You see the curves here. We worked this out with a really detailed simulation. This is what the neutrino signal from a galactic supernova would look like in xenon 1-ton. The arrow is pointing out that at no light in the detector, there's actually lots of events along S2. You see the color scale is the number of events. It's logarithmic. It's red here. Most of the events actually don't produce light. They are too low energies. So what you want to do is you don't want to impose your typical 3-photoelectron analysis threshold, because you can see that up here in a projection. You would cut most of your signal away. What you actually want to do is you want to impose a mild criterion or maybe get rid of single electron S2s, right, because that's photoionization. But you can afford, you make a threshold of 2 or 3 electrons, which is very small. Once you do that, then your background drops to like less than 10⁻²⁰ events per ton per second. And so over the few seconds of a supernova burst is completely negligible. So you can actually measure the entire signal here. And you know, depending on where the galactic supernova, where it actually happens, you can get from, you know, a few to tens of events, depending on. I mean, if Betelgeuse goes off, we will have 100 events. So we can really do some physics with that. Point being that xenon 1-ton running right now, dark matter detector right now, is actually a supernova neutrino detector with a sensitivity of more than 3 sigma across the entire Milky Way. That's a blue curve. Of course, the sensitivity will go up as you build bigger and bigger detectors. With a Darwin-type detector, say 40 tons here, you will have sensitivity to the small Magellanic clouds and beyond. So as far as we're concerned right now, yes, there's only one galaxy. But that'll be more as we go. What can you do with that? Again, you can measure the total neutrino, that energy that goes in neutrinos. And you could, for example, distinguish between the accretion phase from the Kelvin-Helmholtz cooling phase in a neutrino flux, which would be very nice to do. Okay, so to summarize, what we built is a nuclear recoil wimp detector. What we then realized is that we're having a multi-channel dark matter detector, but what we're actually having is like a really multi-purpose experiment that can do a lot. Anything that scatters off a xenon nucleus or a xenon electron, even at lowest energies, we can look for and we can study. And so these detectors are much more than just a WIMP search. Like all those red points are actually, I have slides for all of those. We can talk about all that. There's a long list of channels that we can do. It's truly multi-purpose experiments. And of course, I'm really excited and looking very much forward to this workshop, because what I would love to do is add a couple more points here or see where we can improve on what we're doing right now. Thank you so much.
CNO neutrinos?
That
is the most sensitive to solar models,
metallicity. Yeah, no. Do I have the plot here?
I can get it out like one time and like
ultra. Yeah.
But
PP is low energy. So there's this, if you look at the flux as function of energy, right, then there's your four sore thumbs that stick out, and that's PP solar neutrinos. You will see those first if you can measure low energy neutrinos, in our case, measure scattering of electrons. Or the boron 8 neutrinos, if you can go for coherent scattering. Or if you're worried about high energies, the atmospheric neutrinos are sticking out, but they are like orders of magnitude away from our current detectors. CNO, not happening.
Just comment on that. I don't want to sound critical because I'm a big fan of
you should.
The liquid argon experiments, they can detect CNO neutrinos with electron recoils, at least they claim they can, but you've got this problem with xenon, you've got this beta decay, right, in the same region for electron recoils. So,
is that
a fair reflection of the situation? Are you aware of this liquid argon paper?
Yes, I'm very aware of it.
Yeah.
So, maybe the colors aren't quite ideal. So this is the actual background spectrum in the running xenon-1-ton detector. And so why does the total sum of all the individual colors, green is the most boring one, that's materials, okay, get that. Actually, overall, the most spectral shade is the blue one. That is double beta decay, two neutrino double beta decay from xenon-136. This is a decay that hadn't been measured as little as, what, 5-6 years ago. And now we have an experiment where it's the dominant background. It's quite cool. I really like that. So then when you say you want to measure electron scattering from neutrinos, the three fluxes that you have, see, most of it is PP solar neutrinos, is a log scale. Already beryllium-7 is down by an order of magnitude, and then PEP is another order of magnitude or so below, while at the same time the background spectrum goes up. So I don't see that happening. Once you go to those energies at above 100 keV, why not use boric xenon? Right. Much bigger target mass, you have that threshold. And because of the bigger target mass and the different target, much cleaner. I consider that done. Right. So I don't really see the physics there, unless I'm missing something.
There's a question. When you look at the S2-only analysis, like for example, a single electron, how many electrons would you need to get the Z location from the spread of the electrons? So my memory is the way you guys first did it with xenon 10 was use the spread to get that.
I don't know the answer to that question. A few, not many. I mean, it's a difference between, it's now a mixture of counting statistics and how much you spread the electron cloud out, and then you have to worry that at some point you run into backgrounds which then can pile up to mimic your vitus, like elegant pile. If I had to guess, I would say 5.
Right, but I guess I'm going to
but I don't know.
If you go a little bit above, you know, single electron, you start to kill a lot of these backgrounds.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And that is what has been done in this study. But you know, it only helps so much.
You have the mention of fractionally charged particles. How does it work?
Okay. Let me see whether this works on Federica's computer as well. Thank you very much, Federica, for actually borrowing me your. Now, of course, I'm going through it manually anyway. That kind of. So let's see. Okay. Yeah. So the idea being that if you have a particle that doesn't have integer charges and it is a free particle that travels through your detector, now you have a less than minimum ionizing particle. And so what you get is you get a track in the TPC. There's actually other particles where we do get tracks in the TPC. That's muons. They light the entire thing up like a Christmas tree. It's like, whoa, you get to turn blind. But we can reconstruct them very nicely. The limits that have been placed so far are from those experiments. CDMS has done a very nice analysis, but they suffered from the fact that their detectors are segmented. In our case, we really have one big detector where we can really reconstruct the drug. Nobody has done that in xenon, as far as I'm concerned. No, yet. You can make assumption or you cannot make it. It doesn't matter. I mean, if you need a track length, right? Well, it needs to get underground first. That comes back to John's point, right? I mean, you always have an upper ceiling to start out with. You need to get there in the first place. Yes. Yeah. If you're interested in that, can we talk about it? Because so far I wasn't able to bring out the arguments why I should motivate a grad student to spend a year on that analysis. It's probably what it would take. I mean, we don't usually reconstruct tracks, so nobody really cares about those.
So what do you think is special about the liquid xenon in terms of the fractional charge particle?
Oh, it's just one big detector, so you actually have a nice
track.
Oh, but then you are at lower energies.
That's what I'm trying to get at. So what's special about the lower energies for the fractional charge particles?
That's what this limit shows, right? So the lower you can go, you probe a different parameter range. Paolo.
Yeah. So you have this plot of your ray. And you have this plot of
right
light 13.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
What's happening? So this is sort of flat.
No, it's actually not. yeah, it's actually decaying.
So it is
I'm thinking there might be something else here that makes it look a bit flat.
What is the time scale?
The time scale in lux is, depending on how you look at it, up to 1,000 milliseconds. So half-lives of like 200-300 milliseconds. That's very long, right? Typically those detectors have, of course, trigger rates of a hertz or a few hertz.
So basically you are...
And so meaning you see those...
You cannot...
That's right.
You cannot just be to a large...
Nope, that's... Not for this background. Where you can do it is for the photoionization.
Yes,
they decay much more quickly, but not for those backgrounds.
Could you go back to the slide where you had the Borg-Sino fluctuate and the two metallicity predictions?
Okay. Right, sure.
The thing which confused me, yeah, it seems like there, your uncertainty from Borg-Sino is already less than the theory. So it's not
from
like,
Borg-Sino, by the way. There's already snow expert.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it seems like where you really need to prove is more in the theory anyway, right? Because it's right in the middle, but the uncertainty is smaller than the theory uncertainty anyway. I'm reading that right. Is that correct?
That looks like it. To me, that cries more data.
I would say it cries about theory, right? Because more data, you're probably, unless snow data wrong, you're still going to stick right in the middle.
Well, how about it cries both?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do we have you there. I'm not the person to comment on that.
In these models.
Well, yeah, that's easily agreed on.
So, actually, are we in the also general discussion section?
Yeah, we see.
So this is a point for the both
speakers. Federica, you want to come up?
Sorry?
I have a point for both speakers.
Yes.
So, I was thinking about what you said about the difficulty of calibrating the detectors at extremely low energy.
Yes.
And I have what I think is possibly a good new idea. So one thing you could do is you could take your little detector like that, and you could take some chromium 51 and do ion implantation and stick those chromiums deep in the detector itself. It has a lifetime of about 30 days. So you can put 30 of them in there, and you'll get one per day or whatever. And what those do is that's an electron capture decay. And there's an outgoing neutrino that was used to calibrate some solar neutrino detectors, but don't worry about it, get it? And there's a nuclear recoil. And so the nuclear recoil is, you know, the energy release is about 1 eV momentum. So it's about tens of eV nuclear recoil energy. So now that your detector and others are potentially reaching the tens of eV range for nuclear recoils, you could use the electron capture nuclear recoils as a calibration source, both to measure absolute efficiency, but more importantly, to measure energy response.
Further, not only the neutrino will escape, but also the X-ray.
Well, okay, so there's not always an X-ray. So the chromium decay sometimes goes to the ground state, and there's nothing but a recoil nucleus.
But even if
there's
the
atomic
X-ray.
The atomic X-ray. Right, but the part we're interested in is the nuclear recoil part. Right, there's the atomic electron.
No, I mean, the problem is if you have that, then if you have the atomic X-ray, then you have pilot, you don't know what you're doing. But if your detectors are small, that will escape. So you
okay.
Don't even see that.
That's a friendly amendment, but I like it.
But depends how the energy is, right?
We had a similar idea to do
one. It's about 1 kV.
Sorry?
It's about 1 kV. A water
so your thing that we had actually, we were trying this at Ohio State years ago, but the threshold wasn't low enough, is that the idea was to put a very clean thermal flux to one of these, to a detector that's small, and then you have a neutron capture, and then you have a gamma ray emitted, and the capture can be nuclear excitation. This one should long range, so it escapes your small detector, your crystal.
Right.
And then you only have the nuclear recoil too.
Right.
It's a very similar thing.
I see.
Just that you take advantage of the long range of the gamma ray to not see that
in
your detector.
That's cool. So the thing that got me thinking about it was, until you guys brought up the escaping X-ray, is it would be monoenergetic. So with your neutron source, the nuclear recoils is a spectrum, right? So the nuclear recoil from the electron capture is monoenergetic, and you know the energy. And also sometimes the electron capture goes to an excited nuclear state, and then it's a different recoil. So actually, you have two monoenergetic recoils.
Any ideas that you work on? Because this is a challenge that we are facing at the moment with these extremely sensitive detectors, and we have to obviously find a way in the future to properly calibrate them to have the information energy for the devices.
Yeah.
Up to now, we never thought of implanting something in the crystals and the crystal structure or doing anything in the crystals, but might be able to do
it. Why don't you say plant? Why don't you stick it on the surface?
You could put it on the surface.
Because you do that already without
it. Okay. I was just thinking that then you would have, like, you know, single site, you know, the only thing is happening and it's deep inside, you don't worry about edge effects. But maybe you can put it on the surface.
To discuss, but I'm covering which is a great way to thank again both the speakers from this morning.